Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, here live on this fabulous New Year's morning, wishing you a wonderful and healthy New Year. But before we go any further, I should tell you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We'll have a lot of interesting news stories for you and also some plenty of practical advice. But one of the things that caught my eye initially was research done by Ted Kapchuk, who is actually an acupuncturist who is also an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Med School. Ted wrote The Web That Has No Weaver, which is a classic book of Westerner trying to understand Chinese medicine and acupuncture. Ted just finished reporting a very, very interesting bit of research on placebo. To quote, "The conventional wisdom is that you need to make a patient think they're taking a drug, so you have to use deception and lies in order to get the placebo effect." Ted did something different in his study. Dr. Kapchuk took 80 people suffering from irritable bowel syndrome and explained to them that this was an experiment about placebos, and half of these patients were given a bottle with the word placebo on it, printed in big, friendly letters, which they were told were sugar pills, and the patients were told to take those pills twice a day. The control group was given no treatment at all. At the end of a three-week trial, 59% of the patients taking the placebo said their symptoms had improved, which is interesting because only 35% of the non-treatment group had improvement. This is almost twice. This is a statistically significant result and presumably a placebo effect. And it's the first study of its kind to establish that you actually don't even need to hide the fact that you're giving someone a placebo for it to have a benefit. That's going to take some rethinking. This email from Sandy in Monterey. Pituitary tumor and growth hormone. What would be the best place to start if one has had two pituitary tumors removed, one 10 years ago and one 2 years ago, and can now tell the growth hormone is active again and the headaches are returning? Well, from Sandy's email, I would infer that she had pituitary adenomas producing growth hormone. This can lead to a condition called acromegaly, a kind of giantism. And certain things, your ears, your nose, will continue to grow even after your growth plates have closed in your long bones. If a person has this type of pituitary hormone while they're still a child or an adolescent, they can grow to be very, very tall. Well, the first thing to do, Sandy, is to get a blood level of human growth hormone and see if it's elevated. And if it is, go after an MRI and look at the pituitary and see if that adenoma can be identified. Very sorry to hear that you think that you might have another tumor, but it's also possible that your symptoms could be attributed to something else. Headache is a symptom that could come from different things, and I'm not sure what other symptoms are telling you that the growth hormone is back, but fairly straightforward. And again, sorry that you're having the third time of this. This other email from Dane in Santa Cruz. Dane writes, "Dear Dr. Motika, I'm a 65-year-old male. I'm interested in whether probiotics, specifically Lactobacillus GG, might have therapeutic effects for my allergies and eczema." Well, Dane, I think it's certainly possible that it might. The Lactobacillus strain GG is the one that has the most research associated with it. And most of the research that's been done, because of the nature of research and our paradigm that we want to have one variable, has been done on single strains of probiotics. But there's a lot of indirect evidence that a synergy is actually more effective. So a variety of probiotics in a blend might actually be more useful as a therapy for allergies. I generally recommend 9 to 12 billion organisms of Lactobacillus GG or Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which is a synonym strain, and several other strains. And I'm pulling this out of the air, but I say, you know, five different strains, at least two Lactobacillus species, at least two Bifidobacterium species. And if you're concerned about either Candida overgrowth or inflammatory bowel disease, throw some Saccharomyces boulardii in there because that's been shown to be beneficial in both of those conditions. And also, by the way, for the prevention of antibiotic-induced Clostridia difficile infection. So in people who have resistant C. diff or who have had C. difficile, Saccharomyces boulardii is a useful preventative. Let's talk about something that we can all do to improve our health. Diabetes, hypertension, and coronary artery disease can be cured without pharmaceuticals. So today I'm going to spend some time explaining in detail what we know scientifically and with loads of evidence. We can make simple alterations in the environment and in the behavior that can have profound changes in a person's physiology. This is the first day of a new year. It's time to think in terms of New Year's resolutions. That's why I'm urging you, if you have a suggestion or an idea about how you were successful, a story to tell perhaps about how you finally managed to exercise, or a helpful hint, I'd love to hear it. We are asking and soliciting actively those sorts of responses, as well as your questions and healthcare concerns. Type 1 diabetes, let's start there. This is a disease that needs prevention. And there are several things that have been established scientifically about type 1 diabetes. This is the diabetes that is an autoimmune disease where a person develops cells that attack the beta islet cells in their pancreas and destroy them. And these are the cells that produce insulin. So this individual becomes constitutionally unable to produce insulin, which is a lethal condition. Well, one simple way to prevent type 1 diabetes is to keep the vitamin D levels at about 40 in women during their pregnancy and in infants during the first year of life. High or moderately high vitamin D levels have a strong negative correlation with later development of type 1 diabetes. Another important and relatively simple intervention is breastfeeding. Infants who are breastfed for the first year of life have much lower rates of diabetes type 1 for the rest of their life. This is because one of the major immunologic tasks during gestation and then the first year of life is learning to discriminate between self and non-self. And this type of recognition phenomenon can be derailed. And when it is derailed, it has a permanent and profound effect on that individual's risk to have diabetes of this type triggered. One of the proteins in cow's milk may be a primer to set the system up for autoimmune disease. So that is something to consider. Type 2 diabetes is a disease which is reaching epidemic proportions. If the current curve of the increase in cases continues, we're going to have 20% of the population diabetic with the attendant huge costs in terms of management and morbidity, plus loss of productivity. It's worse than the demographic shift that we worry about when all the baby boomers hit Medicare age. Interestingly enough, type 2 diabetes is more common in people who have low blood sugar in their youth. Well, why is this? Because people who have low blood sugar in childhood or in their teens have a tendency to overproduce insulin in response to a glucose stimulus. An overrelease of insulin is like going to a loud rock concert. The sensors for both sound and insulin are alike in that they get damaged by overload. In the case of insulin receptors, the DNA that codes for the insulin receptor itself gets sealed off and downregulated, so fewer receptors are made. So less blood glucose gets into cells, and the extra glucose in the bloodstream stimulates the pancreas to make more insulin, which in turn further reduces the number of insulin receptors, and around we go on a progressively worsening bad feedback loop. So how do you get off the diabetes merry-go-round? Well, step one, you stop triggering insulin release. This means ignoring the FDA food pyramid and the ADA diet and really drastically reducing simple carbohydrates in the diet. So that means no soda, no lattes with sugar in them, no juices, no starchy sweeteners, no cornstarch. And it means walking away from bread, scones, croissants, calzones, noodles, pasta, ravioli. It means stopping eating all of this stuff if you want to reverse your diabetes. And by the way, type 2 diabetes can be reversed in its early stages. If the pancreas hasn't been too badly damaged by overwork, you can, in fact, get those receptors to come back online. But the longer a person remains in the hyperinsulinemic, hyperglycemic state, the less capable their body is of getting back to normal. So that means you need to learn to cook. That means you need to eat strategically. That means you need to plan ahead and carry food with you that is appropriate for your physiology, your now altered and damaged physiology that you're attempting to rehabilitate. If you're an alcoholic, you don't walk into a bar for a business meeting. It would be silly. You need to give yourself a few years of abstinence before you confront yourself with those kinds of choices. So a person who is striving to cure their diabetes through lifestyle modification needs to do exactly that. They need to modify their lifestyle. And that may mean avoiding meeting your friends at Starbucks. And that may mean getting to the movie just after the previews have started so that you aren't tempted to grab something to eat and sit there and munch through the entire film. I encourage my diabetic patients to validate their food choices by buying a glucose monitor and checking about an hour after they eat a food that they think is going to be okay and making sure it is okay, making sure that it doesn't kick their blood sugar up to 200. And I want to throw out that those test strips are expensive. So if you are a diabetic, there's a monitor called the True Track, which was actually made in England. It was commissioned by the British Health Service because they wanted cheap strips. And the strips are half the cost of the other glucose strips. So this is a bargain. And if you're going to be testing, say, 5 to 6 times a day while you're in your learning curve on what foods you can and cannot eat, you can save yourself a substantial amount of money. The next thing that diabetics have to do is they have to get up on their hind legs and exercise. Just 20 minutes of brisk walking a day. Period. Amen. Just do it. No excuses. No whining. Do you want to take pills and whine about that? Or do you want to exercise and whine about that? Take your pick, because those are your options, and the pills will eventually inevitably burn out your pancreas and lead to the need for increased insulin. So you just don't want to do standard therapy without doing this diet and behavior stuff. Another secret, weightlifting, resistance work, 3 times a week, light weightlifting, build some muscle. The more muscle a diabetic has, when you build new muscle, that muscle is chock full of insulin receptors. Those insulin receptors are working. That pulls the glucose out of the system rapidly when you use those muscles. That lowers the number of insulin molecules that your pancreas releases. That allows for the upregulation of the insulin receptors, and the whole thing starts to back away slowly. There are also natural insulin sensitizers, cinnamon, minerals such as chromium, that's particularly important. Vanadium is another one that can be helpful in diabetes. If you're a Latino or Hispanic, nopal cactus works fairly well. It doesn't necessarily work for Scandinavians, but people with Latino ancestry tend to respond to the nopal cactus, and so that's something else that can be bought at health food stores. And a big one, alpha-lipoic acid, has been shown scientifically to do 2 things that are really useful. One of them is it helps reverse diabetic neuropathy. It's protective to the nerves. That's huge. The second thing, it upregulates insulin receptors. It works like Actos and Avandia, which are 2 PPAR agonist drugs, but it does it in a safe fashion that doesn't cause fluid retention and isn't associated with increased cardiovascular morbidity. Woohoo! Why aren't all diabetics on alpha-lipoic acid? I don't know. Because there isn't a drug rep going around putting pretty pamphlets out there in the doctor's offices. That's, honest to God, the reason that this extremely important substance isn't more widely used. I'll come back and we'll do the same thing again on hypertension, but I need a break. So let's talk to Jim in Big Sur. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don, and kudos to you for showing up on New Year's Day. I'm amazed. I am calling, I'm 67, and it's, as I get older, this vertigo seems to show up more often and last longer. And it happens under 2 conditions. if I'm on my back, like if I'm working on something and I have to be on my back on the floor looking up and my head gets lower than as low as my shoulders or lower, I start to get vertigo and nausea. Also, I don't have to do that if I go for a long time without sleep and I'm really tired. As soon as I hit the bed and lie down on my back, I'll notice this vertigo and nausea. And recently, it's happened a couple of times, and it's been very intense. And I have to sit up and try not to move.
Have you vomited from this?
No.
Okay.
I used to get little flashes of this when I was younger from time to time, and it only would last a couple of hours. I read or heard that it had to do with virus, some kind of virus in the semicircular canals. So what's going on with this? What's causing this? And is there anything you can take for this, which I doubt, but that's my question.
Okay, there's three potential causes for what you're describing. Just the pattern that you're giving me, I think I know which one you have, but there is something called Meniere's disease, which is a swelling of the membrane that triggers the nerves and gives a sensation of vertigo. People with Meniere's will also often swell the membrane that is the hearing membrane, and so they'll have tinnitus. So that's one of the associations we look for. Yes, there is viral labyrinthitis, which would swell the membrane and cause the nerves to be stimulated. And that tends to hit with a cold or with other viral symptoms. It's not usually isolated, but it hangs on for weeks to months and eventually goes away. The one that is most common is called benign positional vertigo, and it tends to ramp up over time, over many years, just kind of episodically the way you're describing it. So I think this one is probably what you've got. And this is the snow globe phenomenon. It's very seasonally appropriate, but you know the little snow globe, you pick it up, it's got the water or the glycerin in the fuzzy white stuff, and you shake it and the snow falls, over the snowman or over the tree or whatever, right?
Right.
Well, your semicircular canals are like three carpenter's levels. If you'll bear with me on the structure here, you've got a flexible platform, that's the membrane, and then hairs sticking up out of the membrane. And on top of the hairs, there's some gooey stuff, and there are little rocks, literally, in the goo on top of the hairs. And the whole thing's in a viscous fluid. So when you move your head, the hairs basically attach to the membrane, the bottom moves with your head, but the rocks give some inertia, and so they bend the hairs. And as the hairs bend, that triggers the nerves and it sends a signal, hey, you just moved. And so that's the source of our awareness of motion. And we have three of them so that we can recognize the X, Y, and Z axis of motion. Now, if the rocks come loose, they bounce around and they randomly trigger hair cells. So when you move and you get a snow globe phenomenon and some of those rocks come off of the gooey membrane and start bouncing around and you have this sensation of movement even though you're not moving. So that's BPV, benign positional vertigo, and there is something called the Epley maneuvers, which I believe is spelled E-P-P-L-E-Y, but I might have the spelling wrong. And these are a series of maneuvers that doctors can do that involve turning your head in a certain direction until you start to have the vertigo and then turning it again. And it's remarkably effective for fixing this. It's not necessarily going to work forever because you can break loose new rocks. And eventually, these rocks tend to, there's a little corner that they tend to gather in and they fall off of the membrane, stop stimulating it, and gather in this little corner and your symptoms go away until you lose some more rocks off of the top of this structure. So you got rocks in your head, my friend.
I've been told that before.
It's spelled E-P-L-E-Y, by the way.
My E-P-L-E-Y.
So go put that into your browser and smoke it.
Epley movement?
Maneuver.
Epley maneuver.
Right.
Okay.
And you will find exercises that you can do that mimic this process. So if you don't want to come down from the mountain down there in Big Sur, you can still do these on your own and probably with some persistence get improvement of your situation.
Well, I will look this up and I will add these exercises to the growing list of exercises I do to keep my body working.
This maintenance thing,
Maintenance, yeah. And more and more time.
Well, that's why you get to retire, so you can spend all your time taking care of your body.
Apparently, that's true. true.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Just to come back to what I was saying earlier about diabetes, I have this article here. Research, a large trial, it was called the Look Ahead, Action for Health in Diabetes Trial. And what they had was about 5,000 people, 60% women, various ethnic minorities, all overweight or obese with type 2 diabetes. What they did was intensive intervention. The people in the intervention group met individually and in groups every week for the first 6 months, three times a month for the next 6 months, and they were followed up by phone or email after that. They had an educational session. They'd come in, at least initially it was every week. They'd get weighed. Their self-monitoring blood sugar records would be compared and looked at in a group setting. They would share information, useful information perhaps about what they had done successfully or not successfully. Then they would have a lesson. Behavioral counselors, exercise specialists, registered dietitians. Over the 4 years, participation in the intervention group had dramatic improvements in fitness, glycemic control, blood pressure, levels of good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, and they lost about 8.6% of their body weight in that first year, compared to about 1% in the usual care group. These people's health status improved enormously, and it was done not by doctors getting out a prescription pad and writing a prescription for pills because of the learned helplessness that doctors have about this. It was done with coaching, with cheerful, bright, chirpy people telling you over and over again, you can do this. And being in a room with a bunch of other people who, between the bunch of you, were seeing success and sharing tips about how to be successful. We need to engineer this into our healthcare system if we are going to dodge this particular iceberg that's right there on the horizon, boatmates. So let's do the same thing about high blood pressure. High blood pressure is a disease that develops in stages. And the earliest stages of hypertension are the so-called white coat phenomenon. So just because your doctors told you, oh, this is just white coat hypertension, my patients tell me this all the time, it's only in your office, doc. When I'm home, my blood pressure is great. Well, I make them bring in their cuff to prove to me that their blood pressure's cuff is working right. And then I believe them and I tell them this. Your body is starting to break down. Your endothelial cells, which line the inside of your blood vessel, are no longer capable of relaxing when they're hit with adrenaline. They stay tense. That tenseness is what drives the blood pressure up. Eventually, your blood vessels will become further damaged and that blood pressure will remain up all the time. If you want to avoid going from white coat hypertension to all the time hypertension, then you need to listen to my words. And if you have recently developed hypertension, you can, in fact, get that to go away. Here's how. Diet and exercise. Is this starting to sound like a broken record? There is a diet that is scientifically proven to lower blood pressure as much as a blood pressure drug. Pick a drug, you can expect a 10% reduction, maybe a 10-point reduction in the systolic blood pressure if you're lucky. This diet will do the same thing. It's not too hard. 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and about 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day, preferably in the form of dairy if you tolerate dairy. Now, 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables is just about impossible to do without juicing some of the vegetables to get that volume. A serving is half a cup, so we're talking 3.5 cups minimum. When you do that, you increase potassium and magnesium in your diet. Increasing potassium and increasing magnesium in your diet lowers your blood pressure. If your gut will take it and not give you diarrhea, it's safe to take up to 2,000 milligrams of magnesium. Another thing that is helpful for early endothelial disease is L-arginine, an amino acid. This can be taken in doses of around 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams, and it can have a very beneficial effect on lowering blood pressure. Also, if your blood pressure suddenly goes high on you, get tested for lead, get tested for heavy metals, but particularly lead has been associated with that, and it's not that hard, even now, to end up with a lead exposure. The next step is exercise. Now, unlike diabetes, hypertensives have to be cautious with weight lifting because when they Valsalva, they can raise their blood pressure further. But brisk walking, light bike riding, at least 30 minutes a day, plus that diet, and you will see a 5 to 10 millimeter of mercury reduction in blood pressure just from these two interventions. Now, here comes the big one. If you have hypertension, you have too much adrenaline for your situation. So you need to reduce your adrenaline. Every single day, you need to do something that is relaxing and calming. It could be meditation, it could be Tai Chi, it could be Qigong, it could be breathing deeply and visualizing world peace. It could be pruning stressors in your life. Maybe you're in a toxic relationship. Maybe you're in a toxic workplace. Maybe you've gotten trained by all of the alerts, beepers, and cell phones in your environment that you're constantly shifting from one thing to another, that you're totally hyped up. Maybe you need to drop the caffeine, not because the caffeine itself raises your blood pressure, that's been pretty much debunked, but because the caffeine creates a state of heightened adrenaline, which raises your blood pressure. So look at your life. Do you have your joy? Do you have your relaxation? If you don't, fix that. This is your body sending you a message. And then if you need to go to drugs, spironolactone, a potassium-sparing diuretic, is one of the most underutilized and one of the most demonstrably effective first-line approaches, because this diuretic raises potassium in the system, and potassium is good for the blood pressure. Let's go now to Candace in Salinas. Hello, Candace, and welcome to the program. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you for taking my call. I've had some questions that I've jotted down for you since I've had time to listen to your discussion about the end of the diabetes discussion and then the hypertension discussion. And so I'm going to ask you right out. First of all, can we get tapes of these discussions somehow or another? Maybe it would be a good fundraiser for the channel.
Yes.
I would love to be able to get these on tape so I can play them for my husband and kids, and I think they need to hear these things. It's easier than to give them a book.
What you can do is direct them to the website, and they can download these things at any time.
Oh, good.
They're up there in the website. This show will be in the archives. So
the
New Year's Day show is going to be up there, and all this information will be there. AskDrDawn.com, and then after next week, it'll be up all next week right on the top of the website, but then it'll go to the archives.
Okay.
And you can look for the New Year's show, and it'll all be there.
All right, great. That's great. Thank you very much. That'll be a big help to all of us. I'm struggling with pre-diabetes type 2. I may even have it. I don't know. I haven't tested in quite a while. I've been living for 4 years in Japan before moving back here to the States, and things got a lot better when I was there because I went to a much more of a veggie diet. I discovered all these fabulous vegetables that they eat there. They have a wonderful longevity record, of course.
And particularly people on Yokohama, but go ahead.
Yeah, but even in Tokyo, I mean, the women there are very active, and I was watching the women pretty much. The men were sort of off my radar screen. They have their own life, and they hang out in bars a lot and things like that. You know, they do a lot more drinking. The women are very cautious about their health and tend to live a pretty
very long time
lifestyle. Yeah. And they live a long time. That's the payoff. So, I was watching that, and I really kind of learned a lot from that and watched their diet, watched what they were eating, took some cooking classes, et cetera. And I would really like to see more of the type of takeout, because, you know, you don't cook a lot there. You end up buying a lot of things. They have fabulous takeout there. So I'm really disappointed when I moved back here to find that there was so little variety in the takeout supermarkets, for example. We've adopted some new things like broccoli salad, but that's hardly new anymore. And, you know, we've adopted some things, but we don't seem to use a lot of imagination in how we use these things.
Well,
much more that could be done incorporating more Asian ingredients, I think, which would spark our imagination and keep us eating healthy diets instead of reverting constantly to the call of our unhealthy habits of childhood.
Well, I have a suggestion for you, Candace, because I think you have a great idea here. That would be, what would it take to interest maybe a local caterer in Salinas, where you live, or in one of the neighboring communities, maybe Monterey, in some of these recipes, and see if these could be provided? Perhaps you could get a pilot thing going with a couple of the local health food stores and collaborate with the caterer with your ideas. And,
right. I think,
you know, try to actually put thought into action. and see if you can get some momentum going, because I do believe that that is one of the real challenges we face is convenience foods.
Yeah, convenience. People want convenience. They don't necessarily want to cook all these things. They don't know. I mean, even now after 4 years, I've got millions of Japanese cookbooks, but I don't have the fingertip knowledge to throw together a meal, a healthy Japanese meal. Mm-hmm. I would like to.
There are so many. There are so many diabetics. There are so many diabetics in this part of the Bay Area that if you could give them some convenience foods that would not raise their blood sugar, I'm sure you would have a market there.
And I think people are looking for healthy, more creative ways with vegetables. They're intrigued, but it's just not out there.
That's right. So we have to put it.
We can grow anything here.
We have to put it out there.
It doesn't make sense that we're not meeting the health demands of our community.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, we have to start with the kids. Let's package the carrots and the healthy snacks with pictures of
dressing or something
like that.
Well,
with cartoon characters. Yeah. Let's use the same Happy Meal kind of thing that McDonald's has played so successfully. Let's put a toy in with the broccoli, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, well, if people can get used to flavors. You know, for example, over there, when they make a salad dressing, they use yuzu, which you cannot find a yuzu. And that's simply a Japanese lemon. And it has a distinctive flavor, and it's a really pretty addictive. I mean, once you start using that, it's fabulous that you can use it in everything. And they don't use hardly any oil at all that way.
We just need to get this going. But thank you very much for your call. It's very intriguing.
Can I just ask you one quick? Can you answer yes or no to these few questions about what we can eat? The question is confusion between sweet potato and yam. Is there confusion? Are they both sweet potatoes, and are they both healthy for diabetes?
They have to be limited. Most root vegetables have to be limited in diabetes because root vegetables.
But the yam is sweeter. Is that okay, though?
Well, what do you mean by okay? In small amounts, mm-hmm. people who are diabetic may be able to eat a yam or a part of a yam, probably not a whole mm-hmm. one, or a whole sweet potato, and not raise their blood sugar. But again, what you do, because physiologies differ, is you eat the portion that you want to eat, and then an hour later, you check your blood sugar, and if your blood sugar is 190, then that's not something you should be eating.
Okay, so same thing with like buckwheat, so anything like buckwheat noodles or multigrain bread, all that.
Exactly, you have to validate it. You have to validate it for your own particular body.
Oh, okay, so it's not, okay. So
yeah, you don't know
so
if
you
it's
can
okay.
eat bread, you can eat, you can eat any of these things if they're made from complex carbohydrates.
No, that's not true.
But, and in a small amount, that's what I've been doing, and I don't know if that's.
I don't know if that's okay for you. The only
no,
way
I don't know either.
So you have to check. But,
okay.
But you know how to check. It's just a matter of, okay, I do this once, and I check, and I make sure that my body at this point is tolerating, at this weight, basically, mm-hmm. is tolerating this food without raising my blood sugar.
Okay.
And it's
thank you so much for your help. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Yes?
Let me just throw in this whole grain thing. A whole grain is an actual wheat berry, okay? Once you take that wheat berry and you grind it up, you've taken a low glycemic food and turned it into a high glycemic food. It doesn't matter if it's whole wheat and has the bran on the outside. That's great. You get B vitamins, but it's still going to raise your blood sugar. So you have to check, and just because it's made with whole grain, do not fall for that hype. That's as ludicrous as light and natural. Made with whole grain. Yes, very nice. It's still going to raise your blood sugar. You have to check the validity of the claim. Let's go to Maria Elena in Salinas. Lots of people in Salinas today. Hello, Maria Elena. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty well. Thank you. And you?
Good. Good.
Right. My question, is there a test for the pancreas for pancreatic function as there is with liver and kidney and all that?
Which pancreatic function, making of insulin or the making of digestive juices? Because the pancreas does both.
Okay, so it's the insulin I'm concerned about.
Okay, yes, there is.
Okay.
It's insulin levels. So we have really two kinds of type 2 diabetics, actually. We have the type 2 diabetics who, when you give them, let's say, a sugar load, they get a bump in their insulin. So they, when you test their insulin in the morning, they've had nothing to eat. Their insulin is, let's say, twice normal, because they have low receptors, and then you give them sugar and check their insulin an hour or 2 hours out, and now their insulin is 4 or 5 times normal, and their blood sugar may or may not be elevated because it depends on the receptors, whether they're going to be high or low. But what they what that person has is that person's got a good, responsive, healthy pancreas that's able to quintuple its insulin output. In contradistinction, later on, that person becomes elderly, their pancreas eventually burns out, and now when you give them that sugar challenge, they start out at twice or three times normal insulin. You check them at an hour later, and instead of five times normal insulin, they're now at 2.5 times. And the blood sugar is 400 because they haven't been able to put out enough insulin, and their receptors are trashed. It's a bad situation. We don't differentiate in clinical practice medically. We do not bother to differentiate between these two groups, and we should, because the management is different. But we don't.
Interesting. Okay, so then my second question, which was my original question, is I have a mallet finger, and I've had it in a brace for 3 months or so, and it's not getting any better. So I think it's time for surgery. And I just wondered how what that entailed, really, and how much, you know, how long I'd be incapacitated with that finger.
Mallet finger is a broken tendon. And so the tendon that extends the finger, that straightens it out, tears off of the bone. And then the finger bends down at the tip, and it looks kind of like a hammer or a mallet, hence the name. When you straighten it out and splint it, if you're lucky, the tendon attaches, reattaches, and is able to heal on its own. And after 3 months, if that hasn't happened, it's probably not going to happen. So what they would do surgically is they'll go in and they'll use strong suture, grab the two ends of the tendon, pull them back together, and oversew it. And then, of course, that repair is initially only as strong as the suture. And I'll tell you, you can take suture, and even if you've doubled it 3 or 4 times, and give it a good hard yank and break through it. So you have to keep that finger straight while the tendons re-knit, and it's another 3 months, really, that you're going to have splinting and be at risk for breaking it, or for tearing it. It'll be 6 months, 3 to 6 months before the tendon is back to a reasonable amount of strength.
Okay, because it's swollen still, and it still hurts when I accidentally bang it downward. You know, I undo the wrapping, and I look at it, and it's like red and swollen still. So I think it's time for some serious action. Okay.
I think so.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. We had an off-air question. I drink 2 cans of diet soda a week. It has Splenda in it. Is that okay? Well, I would say guardedly yes. I don't think that it's that dangerous at that volume. Splenda does contain chlorine. It's basically a sugar molecule with a chloride ion on it that prevents the sucrose from being digested. And so it tastes sweet, but it goes through the system. As that chloride goes through the system, it has an antibacterial effect, and it can reduce the amount of healthy bowel flora. So in general, I'm recommending, if you're using Splenda, you probably need to be taking extra probiotics and kind of trying to compensate for the fact that you're sort of taking a light dose of an antibiotic. And this is the same caution I tell people who are taking colloidal silver for health, you know, taking it orally anyway, that you're probably killing off some bowel flora. Same could be true of oil of oregano or a lot of natural antibacterials. So if you're going to be killing off bowel flora, you probably want to put in a few extra probiotics. But in general, I don't think Splenda at low volumes is going to be an issue. Higher volumes where you're perhaps doing, you know, the equivalent of 4 or 5 sodas a day or that much beverage, I can't vouch for that. I don't really know, and I think it's pushing it. Just to put out an alternative, there are now commercially available extracts of stevia, particularly in liquid form, that I think are quite good for sweetening beverages. If you're going to do sodas, you can buy flavorings and you can get carbonated water and you can kind of make your own sodas using stevia. And that would certainly be a healthier way to go if you really, really have to have a soda. Let's go to our next caller. And we're going now to Karen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Dr. Don.
You're welcome.
A couple weeks ago, I took a fall and had a big pop in my knee. I've seen an orthopedist and had an MRI, and I do have a tear of one ligament and a strain of another.
Which ligament's torn?
The torn one is my medial patellofemoral ligament.
Okay.
And the strain is a medial collateral ligament. So I'm in a knee immobilizer, and I'm allowed to bear weight, and I'll be increasing the range of motion over, I think, 6 or more weeks, and then go into physical therapy.
Good.
What I'm calling for is to find out, is there anything else that I can be doing to help speed ligament healing or soft tissue healing?
A couple of things that come to mind immediately. First of all, how far out from the injury are you?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay.
So to the day, to the hour.
Wow. Well, I would say that the first thing, since you're in the knee immobilizer, mm-hmm. it's important to use the muscles. Now, okay. the medial patellofemoral ligament is the kneecap, so it's part of the quadriceps. And while that's an important ligament, and I'm sorry you tore part of it, it is, however, not mission critical. You've got plenty of other ligament there. Yep. But I would tighten the quads
okay.
with the foot turned out to about, it's the right or left foot?
It's my left leg.
All right, so your left leg, you want to put your left foot as if it were 10 o'clock on the clock dial, with 12 o'clock being your toe straight up, mm-hmm. and tighten the anterior quads. Just tighten it enough to, if you have the foot, the leg straight out, you should feel the heel start to come off the ground a little bit.
Okay, so this is while I'm laying down?
Yeah, this is laying down in your knee immobilizer or not. And what you're doing there is you're tugging discreetly on that tendon, and that will actually help it heal.
Super.
Okay, that, and it will also prevent muscle atrophy, which is going to be an issue, because unfortunately, if you don't do that exercise now, by the time you get to physical therapy, your vastus medialis, the medial quadricep, will have atrophied, and you'll have more to come back from than if you had done these isometric exercises now. So that's key. The second thing is, you're early enough in the injury that proteolytic enzymes might be helpful. This is total alternative health food store stuff. Okay, so I'll put that out there and say that there is research. The research is done by the companies that make the product, so it's suspect from the standpoint of self-interest. But on the other hand, all research pretty much is suspect from the standpoint of self-interest. But products like Wobenzyme, W-O-B-E enzyme, can be very helpful with breaking down damaged tissue.
Great.
So that would be something I would try. You're not too far out for acupuncture to be useful as an anti-inflammatory, and so I would probably go to an acupuncturist and have him hit the ting points for the spleen and liver, which will run through the area that you injured, and that might be a really useful thing to do. It's called a tendinomuscular treatment, and I believe it's taught to most acupuncturists as part of their basic training, so that would certainly be recommended. And I want to emphasize that the physical therapy that your insurance pays for, that your orthopedist orders, may not be as much as you should have.
Okay.
I have a study here that I was going to talk about, so you've given me a beautiful opening. This was a study done in Sweden on amateur athletes who actually tore the ACL, complete tears of the anterior cruciate ligament, which is the football injury, very, very common. We have about 200,000 people getting surgery for this a year. Well, in Sweden, they randomized people to either immediate surgery or physical therapy with later surgery if they didn't improve. And what they found was that the physical therapy, if you did enough of it, was just as good as the surgery. But it did require 60 sessions on the average of physical therapy.
Wow.
So you're talking 3 times a week, that's 20 weeks at 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how much PT it took. Now, could you have done it by learning the physical therapy exercises and actually having the self-discipline to perform them on your own without somebody standing over you with a clipboard? Of course.
Yeah.
But that's where personal responsibility and self-discipline, and that's just hard.
I've uttered those statements before in PT.
That's so hard.
It hurts.
Yes, it does. But it hurts in a good way.
Yeah. And then I guess one follow-up question is, my dog has arthritis, so I need to keep walking her a lot. Is my body going to get whacked out by walking a lot in a knee immobilizer? Like, should I be doing things to, like, I don't know, stretch more? Or?
I would make sure that I'm on level surfaces when
okay.
I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And I'd definitely do cobra stretch and stretch out the hamstrings and stretch out the lower spine.
Yeah.
Because of the knee immobilizer, it's going to change your gait, and you're going to have a swivel to your walk that you wouldn't ordinarily have, and that's going to put stress on your sacroiliac joint. And
it's been suffering already, yeah.
Right, so
okay.
you need to do a lot of stretches and maybe some massage in that area. You might even consider icing it after the exercise and heating it before the walk.
Great. Thank you very, very much.
Good luck, and hang in there, and remember, you can do your own physical therapy.
will that be any different of the kinds of exercises than what they give me at PT? Like, is there something in addition I should be looking up?
Well, they'll give you a good set of exercises for your situation, but you need to do them on your own.
Yes.
Is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Okay, super.
Right.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. So I've got some last minute, really useful bits of information for you. And it's not quite seasonal, but I thought I'd throw these out because I thought they were extremely exciting. This about skin cancer, something we all need to be concerned with, as it is the most common form of cancer. And a recent study showed that Celebrex, which is a anti-inflammatory, it's a COX-2 inhibitor, reduced the number of basal cell carcinomas over 2 years. So this was a study of 60 patients who had lots and lots of basal cells. And the ones who took Celebrex had a 20% increase in basal cells over 2 years compared to 50% in the placebo. So more than cutting in half by reducing the prostaglandin E2 production, which is something that is apparently highly upregulated in precancerous lesions. So both actinic keratosis and squamous cells and basal cells all have real high levels of COX-2. If you take a COX-2 inhibitor, you affect the cancer rate and the progression into cancer. So that's an extremely cool little finding. And related research showed that EGCG, which is the active catechin in green tea, it's epigallocatechin 3-gallate, reduces the chemical damage caused by ultraviolet light in lab animals. So they gave animals green tea to drink, or actually ECGC-laced water, and then gave them enough radiation to cause skin cancers, and they showed a dramatic reduction in new skin cancers. Then they tried putting it in topically, and they topically saw that they reduced skin cancers. So rubbing green tea on your sunburn and drinking green tea before and after reduced skin cancer. And how cool is that? Well, we've come to almost the end of the program, and I want to just take a moment and editorialize a little bit, which is to say that we're in this for the long haul with this body. We tend to think of our bodies like it's a car or something that we can just purchase new parts for, but that's really not the case. You need to do the maintenance and take care of yourself and be good to yourself, not just beat yourself to death. And we're such a productivity culture that we lose track of what life is all about. So on this first day of the new year, take a moment, examine what you really value, treasure what you really have, and figure out a way to do better body maintenance in the new year. This is Dr. Don Motika saying so long, and stay healthy.